The History of Literature podcast is a member of the Podglomerate Network and Lit Hub Radio. Hello, I'm Jack Wilson. Welcome to the History of Literature. Okay, here we go. Welcome to the podcast, everyone. I'm so glad you came here today, wherever you are. I'm so glad you're listening. We have a fun one today. Our screenwriting friend of the show, Brian Price, is here to talk about the Academy Awards, aka the Oscars. We're going to take a little look ahead to this year's movies. We'll ask him about that, and then we'll get right to the heart of the show, which is one of our drafts, Oscar winners by decade. Which decade did Hollywood get right? When were the movies the best? And when did the Academy blow it? And was that because they didn't make good movies then, or because they didn't choose the right movies as their winners? We'll hear Brian's thoughts on all of that coming up. Here's a real piece of karma for you. An email came in this week from a listener, Christian, who is one of our new Patreon subscribers. My thanks to all of our Patreon subscribers signing up for a small monthly contribution over there at patreon.com/literature. We appreciate all of you for your generosity. Christian describes himself as a born-again reader and always hungry podcast listener. And he says, quote, "I started listening to the History of Literature after coming back from a disaster of a trip to Chile in 2017. I went there over a matter of the heart that quickly turned south due to an unfortunate anniversary on her end, in a matter I'd rather never get into in respect to her." Let me just pause there, Christian. I appreciate your discretion here and honor it, but boy, does that phrase fire up the imagination? An unfortunate anniversary on her end. Sounds a little like Gabriel Garcia Marquez. Back to the email. "I found myself walking the streets of Santiago alone and visited Pablo Neruda's house in the city. I knew very little of Pablo Neruda beyond a quote from The Simpsons about laughter being the language of the soul. Shortly after the trip, I decided to buy a collection of Neruda's poetry and looked up if any podcast had done an episode on him. Lo and behold, I found your amazing podcast. I think that might have been the only time I ever shed a tear listening to a podcast, and ever since then, I remained a subscriber. Thank you for this service and pushing me to expand my horizons and read more regularly with your varied topics and discussions." End quote. Well, thank you, Christian. I'm so glad to have you on board, and I'm very touched by your description of listening to the Pablo Neruda episode. And then, lo and behold, the wheels of the universe click into place, and we get this suggestion from Christian in a PS. "If I may make an episode suggestion," he writes, "can you do an episode similar to the Nobel Prize by decade, but with the Pulitzer Prize in fiction? For whatever reason, I'm fascinated by giving credence to and critiquing in hindsight the major award bodies, similar to looking back to Oscar winners from previous years." End quote. Christian, how did you know? We don't have the Pulitzer Prize episode in the works. I'll put that one on the list. But as it happened, I had just recorded an interview with Brian Price about the Oscar winners from previous years, just moments before your email came in. I'm fascinated by this as well, and I think I know why. I'm interested in stories, which films are. They're art, of course, and they're forms of entertainment, but they're also at their heart stories that we choose to tell and that we choose to watch and that we do watch, and that we share with one another. Our whole society watches these stories, love stories, stories about people in crisis, historical epics, and yes, even superhero stories. What does it mean that my grandparents lived during decades like the 30s and 40s? What stories were defining their experience? How did that define their experience? And can I, looking back at those movies, share in the values and decisions and dramas, large and small, that were meaningful to them? When they watched a movie like Casablanca, were they moved? Were they impressed? Did they see Humphrey Bogart and Ingrid Bergman as models for their own behavior? Did they learn from them? And can I look back and do the same? Or has the world moved beyond those values? Are we different? Do we care about different things, face different challenges, understand the human dilemma in some different way, and respond differently? That's what art does for me, and that's why I like looking back. It gives me all kinds of different perspectives, not just on me and you and all of our contemporary peers, but on the millions of people throughout time who have preceded us as listeners and viewers and readers. Stories unite us. When a story makes me scratch my head and I think, this is not all that funny, but it's trying to be funny. I love trying to figure out why that is. Did people actually think this was funny ever? What about us has changed that we don't? And when there is this harmony, when I laugh at Charlie Chaplin, I think, how did he do it? What here is timeless and unchanging? What magic is that? What universality did he tap into? So, yes, Christian, we will be doing some lookbacks starting right now. Your wish is our command. Brian Price, after this. Hello, everyone. This is Jack here to tell you about a way to eat better and easier. That's right, Factor. And they're delicious, ready-to-eat meals. These things are amazing, chef-crafted, always fresh, never frozen. All you do is heat them up and you're ready to go. No prepping, cooking, or cleanup. And you get something healthy, nutritious, and tasty. I love Factor meals, especially on those days when I'm in the office. They're better for me than snacks or junk food, and much cheaper and faster than buying my lunch at a restaurant. You can choose options like Calorie Smart, Protein Plus, Keto, and you can change your schedule to get as much or as little as you need every week, whatever suits you and your family best. Head to factormeals.com/literature50 and use code literature50 to get 50% off. That's code literature50 at factormeals.com/literature50 to get 50% off. Hey, grown-ups, the Cat in the Hat cast is a new podcast from Wondery, perfect for the whole family. Join the Cat in the Hat and your favorite Dr. Seuss characters as they get whisked away on a new adventure every week. Fish dreams of creating his very own polite and quiet podcast. That is, until he gets a surprise visit to his Fishbowl podcast studio from the Cat in the Hat himself, and it becomes very clear that the cat has other plans for the podcast, and those plans are the opposite of quiet. The cat may be disruptive, but it turns out he's also a great help to get Fish out of all kinds of predicaments. Bursting with music, silliness, and rhymes, the Cat in the Hat cast encourages us all to find fun that is funny in every episode. Sing along to new favorite songs, try your luck at Titanic tongue twisters, have some fun with wondrous wordplay, and most importantly, bring your family along for all of the adventures in the Cat in the Hat cast. Follow the Cat in the Hat cast on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen to the Cat in the Hat cast ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or Wondery Kids Plus in Apple Podcasts. Okay, here we go. This is going to be a fun one. It's Oscars season here in the United States, and we're joined by our favorite screenwriting expert, Brian Price, for a look at how the Academy Awards have done over the years. Brian is the author of the book Classical Storytelling and Contemporary Screenwriting, Aristotle and the Modern Screenwriter, which I looked up before we started here. I see that it has 5 stars on Amazon.com. Brian Price, welcome back to the History of Literature.
Well, it is my pleasure to be back with you, Jackie. Looking forward to talking about movies tonight.
Okay, so here's what I have planned for today. We're going to do a draft of the Best Picture Oscar winners by decade. There have been 10 decades so far, starting in the 1920s and running all the way up to this decade, which is about to conclude, the 2010s, which makes me feel old just saying that. But before we begin, let's talk about this year, 2019. Are there any movies from this past year that you think of as standouts?
All right. Well, I have to start by making a confession here, because I know all the critics and the pundits and the prognosticators are all picking Roma as the movie to beat. And I feel like I need to join an AA style group where I would stand up and say, my name is Brian Price and I just don't get the big deal with Roma. Yeah, it's funny. I lecture quite a bit. And in the last month or so, I've been getting the same question everywhere I've been. Somebody will stand up and they'll say, why is everyone going on and on about Roma? Mm. And I have to tell them, you know what? I'm with you. I mean, I really appreciate a movie that was written and directed and produced and, you know, and shot by Alfonso Cuarón, who I've really enjoyed his other movies. But I have to say, one of the things I love about going to the movies is being transported and becoming, you know, unaware that I'm sitting in the theater watching a screen. But that was a movie that every moment I was just so aware that I was watching a movie. And that was my take on it. So how did you feel about that one?
That's interesting. Well, I haven't watched it yet. I was going to say, I don't see a lot of movies in the theaters these days unless they involve grown men and women in superhero costumes. I catch up on them all when they hit Netflix and Amazon Prime. And I know that Roma is on Netflix, right? So that is one that I should be able to catch before the awards ceremony, and then I can decide whether I'm going to root for it or not. You know, it's interesting. As I was doing research for this, I tend to come up with what I think are standard opinions or my opinions. And when I think of things like, oh, that was critically well received, I tend to look at the website Rotten Tomatoes, which is like an aggregator of all the reviews and everything. And I noticed they also have a thing on there for the user rating. And I've noticed that there are some years and some decades where the critics and the users are pretty in sync. There's a lot of, you know, 95% from one and 93% from the other. Mm-hmm. Recently, though, there have been some years where the critics are on one page and the users are much further down the scale. Critics are finding something, they're raving about a movie, and the users are in the low 70s or even below. So
interesting.
It kind of makes me wonder if maybe that says something about critics or about, you know, maybe they're just so starved for something that's aimed at adults and aimed at, you know, has a little bit of artistic sensibility that they're just not finding the ones that are also very crowd-pleasing.
Well, I also think that we tend to view movies in the past very differently from those that are contemporary to us, because movies are worthwhile if they have something to say about the time in which they're made. Mm, but at the same time, they need to have this timeless quality that, I mean, we'll talk about this as we talk about the different decades.
Right.
And it makes complete sense that critics who maybe are more trained, you know, to see movies within the context of the history of film might see things that it takes your average audience, you know, a few decades to catch up with.
So it
makes sense to me that these older movies, that there becomes an agreement between critic and your average audience. And it makes complete sense that now there isn't. I think, you know, of the movies this year that I hope will win, you know, I really loved The Favorite and I really loved Green Book. But I also have to say, my fellow screenwriters, you know, may think, may laugh at me, but I loved A Star Is Born. You know, I was just completely captivated from beginning to end. I loved the characters. I loved the story. It just felt completely authentic. I think at one point I realized I'd just been sitting there with a huge grin on my face.
Yeah.
And again, it was just everything I want to go to the movie for.
That, I think we'll run into some decades where we find some movies like that. Big stars, great music, great story, and just sort of all the pieces of a Hollywood picture coming together in a movie like that. That also is something people really love to go see. I feel like there are decades we're going to be going through where that's almost, you see that not only in the winners, but in all the nominees, you can point to and say that, right, that that's a movie like that. That's a movie like that. So another way, just to kind of set up the listeners for this, one of the ways I explained the concept of the draft to you was to imagine that you and I both work for a streaming service mogul who has acquired the rights to all the Best Picture Oscars. And he's given us the chance to each kind of create a channel where we're going to show great movies for people who love great movies, but we need to divide the movies up between us, and we get to pick a block of 10 organized by decade. So, Brian, I'm going to let you pick first. Which decade of Best Picture Oscars would you most want for your collection?
Well, I'm so glad that you're letting me go first, because to me, there's one decade that stands out among all the rest. I know it is a cliche among, you know, film students and cinephiles, but, you know, cliches are based on truth. And there is no better decade for my money for Oscar winners than the 70s.
That was my number one, too. Yep.
Of course, it should be everybody's. And, you know, we've got the two Godfathers. We got,
yep,
French Connection, The Sting, One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, Rocky, Annie Hall, Deer Hunter. I think any of these movies would beat out just about any nominee from any other decade.
Yeah.
And then you look at the ones that didn't win,
yeah,
like, right, Last Picture Show and Chinatown and Jaws and Network and Star Wars, Apocalypse Now. I think in any other decade, the losers would beat out most,
yeah,
of the Best Picture winners.
Yeah.
So very, very strong bench all around.
And they're not just popcorn movies, although they have those too, but there's also,
right,
you know, movies like Nashville and Network and All the President's Men. Mm-hmm. It's just an incredible collection of movies. And it also, it really feels like 10 movies for adults. They're all,
that's true.
You know, they're all like smart, intelligent, but also beautifully made movies. This is the rise of the auteur, I guess you'd say, sort of the,
right,
Hollywood shifting to filmmakers like Francis Ford Coppola. I mean, this is almost like the decade of Coppola. It's 1970.
Right.
Was,
the Conversation and the guy. Yeah.
Yeah, The Conversation. Really. I mean, The Conversation lost to The Godfather Part II.
Right.
And also 1970s victory was Patton, which Coppola wrote the screenplay for. And then,
wow.
Yeah, so he won. So 1970 belonged to him in a sense with screenwriting. 72 was The Godfather. 74, The Godfather Part II beat out his film, The Conversation. And then 1979, Apocalypse Now was a nominee. And I think you kind of can see this throughout. You see the rise of Spielberg here with Jaws. You see Star Wars and George Lucas. And it's just that generation kind of coming into its own. Taxi Driver was Scorsese's movie, 1976.
Oh, that's right.
So it's really, it's just a fantastic decade. I'm glad you chose it, number one, because part of me was worried that because I was a kid in the 70s, that I was viewing these, you know, the way you walk into a school and the lockers all look, you know, you remember the lockers as being giant and the classrooms as being, you know, with 20-foot ceilings or something. And I was a little bit worried that it was just because that I was a little bit biased, that these were kind of the movies that grownups were going to when I was a little kid. But I think, objectively speaking, it was just a fantastic decade for movies.
Yeah, definitely unparalleled with the other decades. We could program a whole, our mogul could host, yeah, a whole streaming service just from that decade.
Okay, great pick. So I am going to take then, with my number one, I'm going to take the 1960s. And I should say,
all right,
the 70s were my number one choice by a mile. And after that, I have a little cluster. So I could have gone in a couple of different directions here, but I'm going to take the 60s. And one of the things I'm going to point out is the range of movies that this is going to give my channel. And like I said, the 70s, the 70s were, you know, movies for grownups. They were movies that I was not allowed to see when I was a kid. But the 60s is giving me a brilliant Billy Wilder comedy, The Apartment, in 1960. Mm-hmm. And we're getting the very good screenplay from 1966, Robert Bolt's A Man for All Seasons, which, aww, is a movie that I love. It's got 1962, a real centerpiece for me, Lawrence of Arabia, which is, I think, one of the greatest movies of all time. And then I have four musicals. So,
two really good ones.
Yeah, right, exactly. So, West Side Story, 1961, My Fair Lady, 64, Sound of Music, 65, and Oliver, 68. So, this channel is going to, you know, it's going to be a little bit more family friendly, I think, than the 1970s package. That this is, I can put some things on earlier in the evening, so to speak, with age appropriate, you know, things for little kids. Hopefully they'll enjoy The Sound of Music and maybe West Side Story. So it also has the civil rights classic In the Heat of the Night, which is worthy, and Midnight Cowboy, which I think is fading a little bit. I tried to watch it with a group of people and they were a little, they weren't really getting as into it as I had hoped. But it does have the Ratso Rizzo character and scene.
Right. I'm walking here.
Yeah, exactly. I wish Butch Cassidy had won that year. I mean, in the 70s, I felt like they were, the choices for the 70s were just home run after home run. A lot of worthy movies didn't win, but it was hard to fault any of the winners. In looking back at the 60s, I kind of wish Bonnie and Clyde or The Graduate had won, or, you know, Butch Cassidy. And the other one is Dr. Strangelove, which I loved when I discovered it as a teenager. I'm not sure it's held up as well for people under the age of 40 or so. It's such a Cold War movie, but I think it probably does, just with the Peter Sellers performances and everything. But
that stands up.
So what do you think, Brian? Were they making watchable movies in the 1960s?
I think any decade, like you said, that begins with a Billy Wilder movie winning is a good decade. Although we have to remember The Apartment beat out Psycho, which I think probably ultimately is a more worthy movie looking back. The one sticking point for me in the 60s, I love West Side Story. I love The Sound of Music.
Yep.
Oliver is a movie I think nobody is clamoring to see anymore.
Yep.
But 1968, let's just talk about 1968 for a second, because that's the year that Oliver won. And the most important movies that year, from my perspective, weren't even nominated. I'm looking at Rosemary's Baby, Planet of the Apes, Night of the Living Dead, and a little movie called 2001, A Space Odyssey.
Wow.
Which maybe ultimately, you know, is the most important movie to come out of the 60s in many ways.
Yeah.
You know, just in terms of the impact that it had on movies and on culture in general. But still, aside from that one year, I would say a very, very solid decade and a really good choice. And I'm bummed that you've got all those movies on your channel.
Well, this, looking at 1968 is interesting because it does seem like a real misstep. And I know that that has been one of the things that, you know, the Academy will get blamed for, is sometimes it seems like the wrong movie wins, but other times it just seems like they completely whiff and they miss the movies that should have been nominated. And before you even get to the ceremony, you feel like the best movie is sitting on the sidelines. And here we have Oliver, Funny Girl, The Lion in Winter, Rachel, which is a Paul Newman film I've never seen, and Romeo and Juliet, which I think was a very popular movie. That was the one with
the Zeffirelli.
Yeah, those are kind of forgettable compared with the movies that you mentioned that weren't even nominated.
I think, you know, you have to look also at the context and the years in which these films were nominated. I mean, there was a lot going on in the country, a lot going on in the world at the end of the 60s, and it's very possible a lot of these voters just wanted to play it safe and non-controversial.
Yeah, that's right. That's interesting. And it also seems like you can start to see, you know, especially when you take a look at the 50s, which we haven't gotten to yet, but when you start to see the 60s moving forward, you can kind of see the breakdown of the Hollywood, you know, you see the cracks in the Hollywood system.
Right.
And you can start to anticipate the 70s are around the corner. You know, Butch Cassidy comes in 1969, but you can see them hanging on to these musicals. It almost feels, my parents were My parents basically were, high school students in the 50s. And then they immediately became school teachers. And so they were suddenly the establishment, age 21 right. or 22. So my parents turned 22 in 1962. And they spent the 60s, wearing tie. My dad wore a tie to school, to teach school. And meanwhile, these teenagers who were only about 5 years younger than him were going through the 60s. And I almost feel like these were the movies that my parents had the soundtracks to, Oliver and The Sound of Music. And there was another, Hello Dolly was a big one in our house. And it almost feels like there is probably a whole generation of Academy voters who were not ready to move on to Rosemary's Baby or 2001 A Space Odyssey.
True. Very, very true. One final thing I would say about the 60s, though. You talked about 70s being the decade of Coppola. The 60s is the decade of Ernie Lehman, screenwriter and producer. He wrote North by Northwest, but he also wrote West Side Story and Sound of Music. I mean, he Hello, yep. Dolly, he produced.
Yeah.
So he's a name that maybe a lot of folks listening to this podcast might not be familiar with, but really, really major force in filmmaking, especially in the 60s.
Mm. And I see him on here as Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf is another movie that he produced.
Yeah.
I think I mentioned Bonnie and Clyde a little bit. That's one that I really should have mentioned as being kind of the... where you see the 70s being around the corner.
That's yes. And Easy Rider as well, I think was, 69.
Yeah. And then I just can't, but then my eye drifts down to the 70s and I see 1970 Patton won, but the nominees were Five Easy Pieces and MASH. And
right.
It just seems like, the floodgates were about to open. Okay. So what is your number two?
My number two, let me see. All right. In terms of movies that matter and that reflect their time and remain timeless as well, I'm going with the 90s.
Interesting.
I think any decade that produces Unforgiven, Schindler's yep. List, American Beauty, and Titanic, I think four very, very different movies, but all future classics, certainly. I will give some caveats to the decade. I think Goodfellas should have beaten out Dances with Wolves. I think either Shawshank Redemption and Pulp Fiction are superior to Forrest Gump. And I will wonder to my dying day how Shakespeare in Love won Best Picture over L.A. Confidential. But, the Academy hit better than 50% that decade. And I would say those winners that I mentioned are up there in the pantheon of the great movies of all time.
Yeah, they are very watchable movies.
That is damning with faint praise.
No, I don't mean it to be. I mean, some of these, you kind of have to be, some of these decades, you kind of have to be a real film buff in order to want to run through some of the nominees. But there's a lot of popcorn movies here and a lot of crowd pleasers. And it's still high quality, I feel, but it's the sort of, Braveheart one or,
right.
Titanic is certainly filled the seats. Schindler's List is a serious movie, but it was it also did well at the box office. And, these are Silence of the Lambs is still kind of a Halloween classic. And maybe it's because it's only 20 years old or so. And that's why these are still watchable movies. But I feel like, I could put on Apollo 13 for my kids, one of the nominees that lost, or Fargo or Jerry Maguire or The Postman, Il Postino. And some of those would still be quiz shows. Another one I'd like to show them. They were making movies for grown-ups that people liked going to see.
Yes, very true. All right, so that was my pick for number two. What's your pick for number two?
Okay, well, I am going to take the 1980s. So I almost feel like I was anticipating that you were going to take the 70s. And so my number two, I put the 60s, and the number three were the 80s, as if I had to take whatever I could get that was closest to the 70s. So this has got Ordinary People, Chariots of Fire, Gandhi, Terms of Endearment, Amadeus, which I still love, Out of Africa, Platoon, mm-hmm. The Last Emperor. These are good movies or great movies with great scripts, great stars, great directors. Rain Man won. Driving Miss Daisy, I think, is kind of viewed as a misstep, which was a bit of a weak year. Mm-hmm. Born on the 4th of July was nominated that year. Dead Poets Society, Field of Dreams, and My Left Foot. You can kind of feel like it's maybe starting to get a little more, I don't know, these are movies that are maybe trying too hard to win awards, it seems like, or something something is happening here where it doesn't feel as edgy or as, you know, we're getting kind of far away from the 70s here. It doesn't feel like it's artistically as ambitious, not in a avant-garde kind of way, but a movie like The Godfather is you feel Coppola's vision. It's breaking ground, and it's kind of cinematography, and it's firing on all cylinders. And as we move away, it starts to get, you know, we still have big movies with movie stars, but there just seems to be something a little safer about these movies, especially toward the end of the decade. But, you know, the 80s also had a lot of movies that didn't win. Mm-hmm. But, you know, Raging Bull, Raiders of the Lost Ark, E.T., Tootsie, The Verdict, Hannah and Her Sisters, and Room with a View. Those are all still movies that I have a lot of affection for. And again, this might be because of my particular age, but these were all movies that I enjoyed, and I think I would give them a couple hours of my time now.
I agree. We're of the same generation. I think I have a lot of affection for the 80s. Mostly for sentimental reasons. I think that these movies that you mentioned do feel a little bloated to me. Mm-hmm. I mean, even when I look back at things like, Out of Africa and The Last Emperor and Chariots of Fire, they're movies that do seem a little bit like spinach to me.
Yeah.
They did at the time and they still do. I don't seek them out. And like you said, they were far better movies. You know, you mentioned Raiders and E.T. and Empire Strikes Back. I'm a huge Big Chill fan, and Witness and Broadcast News all came out of the 80s. But I think it's, you know, when you think about the decade of the 80s, you kind of think about bloated ostentation. You know, people were putting on the appearances. You know, the fashion of the 80s is horrible. So it's perfectly fitting that the movies themselves, you know, just kind of, They kind of check off the boxes of what you expect in an Academy Award movie, like you said, without the soul of the, you know, the artist taking real chances, I think.
Right. So the a movie like Gandhi might be the equivalent of the girl at my high school who used to use an entire can of hairspray on her hair every single day.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. Although, to this day in my classes, I teach Tootsie, and I don't know that Gandhi has ever crossed anybody's lips in my classes.
So yeah.
Again, looking back, you kind of see these movies a little bit differently.
Right. Okay, let's take a quick break and be back with the rest of our picks of the Oscar winners by decade. Okay, well, we are so far in sync. We have taken my first four, so I'm interested to hear on where you go from here. So what did you take as your number three pick?
Let me see. I am going for my number three pick with the 50s for the trifecta of All About Eve on the Waterfront and Bridge on the River Kwai.
Yeah.
I think, you know, you look at these movies, I think most of them I can give or take, but I think these three are going to end up on any, you know, film lovers, 25 best films of all time.
Yep.
I have to say, you know, to me, the tightest race of the decade, looking back in hindsight, goes to All About Eve versus Sunset Boulevard. I know we talked about Billy Wilder before, but just a master. I would have certainly selected Sunset Boulevard, but look at all the also-rans. You got High Noon and Streetcar Named Desire and Shane and Some Like It Hot, which didn't win, but one of my all-time favorite movies. So it is a very solid decade, and I'm going to program it in my channel.
That is a good...
What do you think of the 50s?
I like the 50s, kind of for the movies that you mentioned. There are some movies that I've watched, and I kind of scratch my head. I've never been able to understand the appeal of Marty or Gigi.
I'm with you there. Yeah.
Around the World in 80 Days, I think we've probably, you know, there have probably been TV versions of the movie that are just as compelling at this point. But, you know, it's interesting, All About Eve, I almost feel as if, you know, there's an interesting thing that happens when a movie loses, like Billy Wilder lost to what is basically a Billy Wilder movie that he didn't write. You know,
that's so true.
And I was talking about this. I was talking to a friend about Hitchcock movies, and I noticed Gaslight is in the 40s. And that's a movie that I think, you know, Hitchcock basically, like the best Hitchcock movie he never wrote or that he didn't direct. And he used to say that everyone just assumed that he wrote it or that he directed it, you know, because of how close it is to him. And it feels that way with All About Eve. That's a movie Billy Wilder, I'm sure, watched and enjoyed and maybe didn't mind losing to, or maybe it made it worse that it was, you know, maybe he would have preferred to lose to King Solomon's Mines or something that was not quite in his wheelhouse the way that was.
That's very true.
Okay. I also, you know, An American in Paris is kind of an interesting one for you. I think, you know, that'll be a good one for your channel to give you a little bit of music and a little bit of color. It's got the great Gene Kelly in it. Again, it's a little bit long and maybe a little slower, but it's got some beautiful scenes and choreography. I remember enjoying that when I watched it. And if you take some nominees from your years, A Streetcar Named Desire is in there, and you definitely are getting some between the 50s and the 70s. You sort of own Marlon Brando, so you're
yeah, that's true. We might have to rename the channel.
Yeah. Okay, so I'm going to take the 1940s.
Okay.
Next, I had it on my list as fifth, and I think if Citizen Kane had won in 1941, I might have even bumped it up to third or fourth, although that was a pretty loaded year with the Maltese Falcon and Suspicion and the Little Foxes, and then they all lost to How Green Was My Valley, which...
Yeah.
A bit of a puzzle. Mrs. Miniver is one I haven't ever been able to get into. And again, I wish the Magnificent Ambersons had won that year, except I would also need to really rewrite history and make it the actual Orson Welles version rather than the one that was chopped up at the time. But the reason why I'm taking the 40s is really the miracle of Casablanca in 1943, which won Best Picture. And I just feel grateful. These were years where they had a ton of nominees. This was, you know, eight, I guess, or 10 maybe. And I'm just glad that Casablanca could have very easily not been recognized because it's not a big budget movie. It had all of those production issues with the casting. And, you know, it was such a lightning in a bottle kind of picture the way that it was made. I'm glad that they recognized it as Best Picture and that it got the credit it deserved. Gentleman's Agreement was an interesting choice in 1946. I've watched that. It's sort of, I feel like the 40s has a lot of good movies that I enjoyed or that I respect. They're not my favorite movies. The Best Years of Our Lives is kind of like that. Hamlet, the Laurence Olivier Hamlet is like that. And the other thing that is a little unfortunate with the 40s is Hitchcock's Rebecca won him the Best Picture Award, but that's not even my favorite Hitchcock movie from that year. Foreign Correspondent, which I prefer to it, was a nominee. And that year, also The Great Dictator was in there, The Grapes of Wrath, The Philadelphia Story probably would have been my choice for Best Picture. So
yeah,
I don't know. It feels like I'm not as in sync with the Academy's choices. But then again, you know, they were choosing, what has it been now, 50 or 60 years ago, so, or more, 60 or 70 years ago. So from where I sit today. So I guess it's maybe not a surprise that their view of what was worthy is not identical to my view.
True. They had good intentions. I think Gentleman's Agreement also with Lost Weekend and all the King's Men you know, these are movies kind of striving to be current and important in terms of the issues of the day. So not just escapist material, not just musicals. We had some thoughtful movies that decade, but I agree with you. You picked the decade for Casablanca, one of the best movies of all time, and it makes it worth it to have all 10.
I could probably just run that on a loop.
There you go.
I'll have entire days where I'm just doing a 24-hour Casablanca, which you'll be able to do with The Godfather, and probably you could probably do that, and you could probably win the ratings game.
Well, then you should alternate Casablanca with its sequel that I think David Soul starred in at some point as a made-for-TV movie.
Oh, interesting. Okay.
So. I don't even remember what they called it, Casablanca 2. All right, so my next pick, I'm going with the 30s. And I'm going with the 30s because I think It Happened One Night and You Can't Take It With You are two classics. And I love the fact that this was back in a time where comedies could really win these top honors. That doesn't really happen anymore.
Yeah.
But I choose a decade just for one year. You know, we talked about 1968 as being a major year for movies. 1939, probably the single greatest year for movies. They gave it to Gone with the Wind, but that was the year of Ninochka, Stagecoach, Mr. Smith Goes to Washington, The Mice and Men, a little movie called Wizard of Oz.
Yeah,
you know, I think that year's nominees alone provide us with a decade's worth of Best Picture winners, if we're allowed to include the losers as well.
Yeah, Wuthering Heights.
Wow, can you imagine Gone Wuthering Heights? Yeah.
Yeah, with Laurence Olivier and a Ben Hecht script.
I just think Gone with the Wind and Wizard of Oz, the fact that those two movies came out in the same year, Victor Fleming, is just astounding.
I'm a little jealous of you from a sort of film buff perspective for a couple of movies that you get along with the 30s. Mutiny on the Bounty.
Oh, yeah.
I don't know if my kids would sit through it, but it's certainly one that I've enjoyed on a kind of Turner Classic Movies night. And Grand Hotel, which has this cast of Greta Garbo, Joan Crawford, John Barrymore, Lionel Barrymore. It's fun to see these people knowing that they were kind of the big stars of the 20s and 30s. It's just fun from a movie history perspective to get a glimpse of these absolute legendary stars.
Absolutely. Man, that was a big movie star vehicle and soon to be a small screen vehicle with Eva Longoria. I think Grand Hotel is a television series coming up very soon.
Oh, wow. I didn't know that. So let's see. It is my pick. I got to make sure. We skipped over a few that I had higher on my list. So I will have to. This is getting to the part of my list where I start to get a little bit sad. Because I'm going to take the 2000s. And
okay, I'm with you there.
I get a little sad because I feel like we stopped making these great movies and are now just making pretty good. Crash is certainly a weak entry on this list. But movies like Gladiator is okay, A Beautiful Mind, Chicago, The Lord of the Rings, Million Dollar Baby, The Departed. You know, a lot of these movies. Okay, so in 2008, Slumdog Millionaire won. And it beat The Curious Case of Benjamin Button, Frost Nixon, Milk, and The Reader. Now, out of those, I guess if I had to rewatch one of them, it would probably be Frost Nixon. But that's like 100 movies that you would see on Netflix or Amazon Prime these days, where it's smart and it's well made and it's got a, you know, a good screenplay. It's an interesting historical topic, but it's not exactly Lawrence of Arabia or something where you're going to make a night out of going to the movies and feel like you've, you know, had a transformative experience. Even the other, some of the other winners too, they feel like leftovers to me. I mean, Chicago is, I'm not sure that's one of the 10 best musicals of all time. And No Country for Old Men is, I'm not sure if it's one of the Coen brothers' best five movies, or The Departed is not Scorsese. It's not peak Scorsese. It just feels a little bit like I don't know, the momentum maybe was moving away from these fantastic movies like The Godfather and even the ambition to make a movie like that and getting more toward, I don't know, if the studios have taken over again and maybe there's a little less room to expand and have the kind of sweep or scope or ambition that those movies had or what exactly it is. But I feel like they feel lukewarm to me.
I'm totally with you. That decade's a real mishmash. I'm never going to sit through Crash or The Hurt Locker again. But, you know, those years, Brokeback Mountain and yeah. Avatar are movies that I would see. Right. You know, over and over again. I'm actually really psyched for the Avatar sequels. But I'm a big fan. I loved A Beautiful Mind. I loved Return of the King.
Yep.
You know, these are movies to me that I feel compelled to watch if I happen to find them while I'm channel surfing. I'm not seeking them out. It's kind of what I call the Galaxy Quest effect.
Yeah.
You know, if I'm flipping through channels and Galaxy Quest comes on, I got to see that through to the end. And I feel the same way about The Departed and Slumdog Millionaire. They're not particularly great movies in the pantheon of great movies, but they're serviceable.
Yeah, I am the same way. I mean, there are a lot of good movies. You know, Michael Clayton, I think, is a good movie. Little Miss Sunshine, Capote. Oh, yeah. You know, they have something good about them. But then there are movies, you know, like The Aviator and Seabiscuit that just feel a little bit warmed over, like they were trying to find a movie that they thought would be that maybe the field of nominees was a little thin for them to try to pick from.
That is so true. Wow, you compare it to a year like 1939, where any of those movies could have been a winner, and yeah, you kind of scrape in the dregs, but you're leaving the real dregs to me. with my next pick, because then I've got to go with the 2010.
Yeah.
Of which there were only really, it's not a complete decade.
Right.
So in that way, it's not fair. I will say that Birdman is one of my absolute favorite movies in recent memory. That's a movie I just adored when I saw it.
Yep.
The Artist too is a movie I really, really love, but it was a complete surprise when it won. I think Spotlight is solid. I love that Guillermo del Toro was long overdue to win, but Shape of Water is certainly not his best movie.
Yep.
I was more excited when they made the mistake of pulling La La Land out of the envelope than when they corrected it with Moonlight. But, you know, going back to our earlier conversation, if they give this year to, you know, Green Book or The Favorite or A Star Is Born, again, that's where all my votes went this year. Over Roma, I would be very, very excited and have very hopes that this decade is going to shape up to be a more competitive one.
Yeah.
What do you think about this last decade?
Well, you know, it is, again, I'm starting to feel like I'm not seeing a lot of distinction between the movies that won and movies, you know, I guess it has collapsed where the streaming services, you know, Roma, that was never released in the theaters, I don't think, was it? They now just, or did they have
they
to?
They did. They have.
Okay.
Yeah, they have to release it. It got a pretty much like a 2-week head start over Netflix. I saw it in the theater. And when you see on a big screen a close up of a puddle for 10 minutes, it makes you want to dive into your bucket of popcorn. It doesn't have the same impact. I started to watch it again on the small screen, and it's actually a much lovelier movie on the small screen, especially if you're not coming at it with all of the expectations you have, you know, for an evening out at a big theater. So for those folks who haven't seen Roma, I definitely think it's a better movie on the small screen than the big one.
Yeah. Or The King's Speech is a good example of what I'm, I guess, trying to put my finger on, where it's, I remember enjoying it. Critically, it did very well, and was popular with moviegoers, too. I'm not so sure it's any better than The Queen.
Yeah, probably not. It's a movie that you wouldn't be surprised to see made for Netflix. There's
right,
nothing particularly
exactly.
cinematic about it.
Yeah, maybe that's what I'm I'm sort of getting at is it doesn't, and maybe part of this is because it's almost too recent for me, where I can look at a movie that has Gary Cooper or Humphrey Bogart and feel like I'm watching these giants. And maybe, you know, 20 or 30 years from now, people will feel that way about Ben Affleck in Argo or, you know, Michael Keaton in Birdman. And I'm just not in the same boat. I view them as lesser mortals than some of the superstars from the past. But, you know, the Brandos and the Jack Nicholson and the Dustin Hoffmans. So maybe I need to let the 2010s get a little more seasoning before I dismiss these movies, but I had it as ninth on my list.
And it was ninth on mine. And I think it goes back to what we were saying before. These movies, you kind of have to take some time to digest them, to really put them in the context in which they were made and see if there are aspects of them that stand the test of time. I think Gravity, you know, talking about Alfonso Cuarón again, that's a movie I loved when I was watching it. I don't know if it had any resonance beyond that initial experience of sitting there. But I bet in the future, I'm going to still enjoy watching Midnight in Paris, one of my favorite Woody Allen movies. So there are definitely a handful in there. And I look forward in you know, 10, 20 years looking back and seeing what were the movies that really did emerge as the meaningful ones. We leave you with only one decade to pick here for your last
So I am going category. I'm going to take the 1920s with my last pick, the one that's left to me. The listeners might not be aware that I think the reason why we're laughing here is there's only two pictures, and I actually haven't seen either one of the ones that won.
Me neither.
Wings is a silent war film starring Clara Bow, who is famous as the It Girl. So that would be fun to watch, I guess. Although silent movies for me, frankly, if it's not Charlie Chaplin or Buster Keaton or Harold Lloyd, I have a hard time sitting through the entire thing. The other film that won was The Broadway Melody, which was a hit, and I enjoyed reading about this. It had sound, and it was in color, so it kind of stood out as an early adopter of those things, although they released a silent version of it because many movie houses still didn't have the ability to play sound. So imagine if you went to see this movie called The Broadway Melody, and you got there and found that it was just a silent film. Here's the thing, though. If they had started the Academy Awards earlier, I think the 20s, assuming that they picked all the right movies, the 20s could have been much higher on the list. I picked some out. 1920, we could have The Cabinet of Dr. Caligari. 1921, we could have The Kid. 1922, Nosferatu. 1923, we get Safety Last with Harold Lloyd. 1924, Sherlock Jr. with Buster Keaton. And then 1925, we could either take another Charlie Chaplin with The Gold Rush, or we could take The Battleship Potemkin the same year. So that would have been a pretty solid decade.
Yeah, that would have been great.
Okay, so is there anything that we haven't said that you noticed as you went about this exercise about the different decades or the trends? I mean, one of the things that jumped out to me was the flush of musicals and how easy it was seemingly for a musical to win, or maybe it, I guess that just speaks to the type of musical that was being made with big budgets and, you know, the 2.5 or 3 hour musical with big scenery and characters and maybe playing off of the popularity of Broadway musicals at the time, whatever the reason was for it, that jumped out at me as those all being kind of clustered. Were there any other trends or anything that you noticed as you were going through this exercise?
Well, I think one of the things about the musicals, just to play off that, kind of goes back to, you really have to dig into what was going on that year and what was happening in the culture to get a sense of why the Academy was choosing the movies that they did. And certainly Westerns had clusters. Movies about World War II had clusters, like you said, so we can kind of look at these movies and not just judge them as films in isolation, but ask questions about what do they say about the time in which they were produced and being granted these honors. So we kind of made fun of Oliver in a way that there were so many better movies that came out that year. But I would be very interested in looking a little more in depth as to what was going on in Hollywood, particularly at that time, to have the voters feel like that was going to be representative of the state of the art at the time.
Yeah.
Now, I know the Academy's done a lot this year trying to open itself up to, more movies in the categories, a more diverse group of nominators and voters. And it'll be interesting to see how that plays. Spike Lee got nominated for the first time this year. Is that even possible with this body of work?
Yeah. Yeah. He could be a long shot to win, but one of those where they give you the award because as a career achievement, almost like The Departed.
Right.
Do the Right Thing, really. That should have been nominated.
I think it won at Cannes that year. But I think I do recall Spike Lee saying something recently, if they hadn't opened up the membership to a more diverse group, he doesn't think Black Klansman would have been nominated this year.
Right.
But you look at things like, If Bill Street Could Talk, even Black Panther.
Yeah.
The first superhero movie to be nominated for Best Picture. We are getting to see different kinds of movies that are reflective of the changes that are going on in the culture, and with Me Too, with Black Lives Matter, gay marriage, all these underrepresented constituencies are having movies made that reflect their experiences, and now we're really seeing them at awards time. So looking back, I think people will make that judgment. What was going on in 2018 and 19 that's reflected in these particular choices?
And you know what? Someone who's listening to this podcast in, say, this episode 20 or 30 years from now might say, too, is given that the Academy Awards ceremony, the ratings for it is just on this total downward trend, they might listen to the two of us talking and say, didn't you guys realize that the 70s, you were glorifying the 70s. The 70s weren't over. They were, in fact, coming back around. There was a renaissance in that style of filmmaking and that freedom to make movies. They just weren't being made by Hollywood. It was being made by production companies for streaming services and cable channels. And there was this boom in artistry and quality and acting and cinematography and all of that. It was just all the innovation was being done at the level of television or movies that you could watch on your iPad. And that may be, looking back, that may be the transition that we're going through now.
I think that you're absolutely right. I think the best dramatic narratives that we're experiencing these days are all happening on the small screen, not just in terms of, a device with which to distribute more conventional movies, but in terms of how the stories are being told. I think the long form, serialized, finite television series, 10 episodes, a beginning, middle, and an end, we never got to see those before, except in the rare instances of like a television miniseries. But now more and more on Amazon, Netflix, you see these little stories, things like, Safe or The Bodyguard.
Mm.
Stranger Things.
They're
like movies in how they're structured. It's just we get to space them out over time and get a much, much more in-depth, leveled, layered narrative because it's 10 hours instead of two. But I think you're absolutely right. I think we are kind of at a golden age when we look back. It's just not in the theater. It's in the living room.
Mm. Well, and as my kids will probably be someday nostalgic for their era of movies, being launched on Netflix and the actors and the directors and everyone tweeting at each other about the launch of the movie on Netflix, I will probably go to my grave with nostalgia for the era of the 70s and 80s and the Academy Awards ceremony where it was the second biggest, show on TV each year after the Super Bowl and everyone was wearing tuxedos and you got a chance to glimpse these stars that you didn't otherwise have a lot of access to. And they would be sitting in the front row and they would have a a Billy Crystal or a Johnny Carson or a Bob Hope or somebody up there at the podium. And it may be an era that's fading, and it may even be bygone at this point, but it is going to live on for me as, you know, the period where movies really were larger than life.
Well said.
Okay, well, let's leave things there. Brian Price, as always, thank you for joining me on the History of Literature.
My pleasure, Jackie. I hope we can do it again soon.
Okay, there we go. My thanks to Brian for joining us. I had a lot of fun. And as always, I value Brian's insights into these movies and how they work. Go check out his book on Aristotle and the Modern Screenwriter. And my thanks to Christian and all the other Patreons who helped to make this show possible. Your generosity is much appreciated. We'll be back soon with a jump back into the Victorian age and another trip through the Middle Ages coming up soon. And Mike Palindrome with some more contemporary fiction. Mike's working hard on his David Foster Wallace Part 2. And he and I will also have a discussion of a 20th century master known for his brevity and his cleverness, which is not David Foster Wallace. How's that for a teaser? I'm Jack Wilson. Thank you for listening, and we'll see you next time. Thank you.